and call to order the regular session of the Springfield Commission for November 20th, 2018. And we'll start off with formal attendance. Commissioner Bergen?
Here.
Commissioner Gill?
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood?
Present.
Commissioner Coivalla is present. Commissioner McGinley?
Here.
Commissioner Vose?
Here.
And Commissioner Land?
Present.
Okay. If we could all rise, I will ask Commissioner Sherwood to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have any adjustments to the regular session agenda? Hearing none. Is there any business from the audience which is not directly addressing the subject that we're going to deal with tonight? Hearing none. We have on our agenda the approval of minutes dated March 20th, 2018. Do we hear a motion or corrections to those minutes?
I'll ask, Mr. Chair. Previously, you'd indicated you wanted to make corrections. Have those been done to your satisfaction?
They have.
All right. I'll make a motion then that we approve the minutes for the March 20, 2018 regular session of the Springfield Planning Commission.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Commissioner Coivalla, I did see motion in the audience that indicates there may have been somebody who did want to speak.
Okay, would you please fill out a comment card to give to the planning secretary? But you can go ahead and address the commission right now. Please limit your first of all, give your name and address for the record and limit your testimony to 3 minutes. Thank you.
My name is Jim Guthrie. I live at 1475 South Brooklyn. The topic, I guess, is the neighborhood I live in. I've lived there for 32 years, and it's been a wonderful place to live. But I was kind of looking forward to coming into the 21st century and getting to hook up to the sewer, and so I kind of thought that the roundabouts were like an indicator. I've been dealing with some really difficult problems with homeless next door and with the business interests that are on Franklin Boulevard. But it turns out that isn't likely to occur. And I don't think that the neighborhood is going to go away. I think that the problems that we represent are very difficult and probably do take a lot of time and planning to understand, but they're very real and they won't go away. And I understand that they probably are not on the agenda at this point, but I would suggest that we put some thought and energy into how to address the 1,400 people or so that live in Glenwood. And most of them live in substandard housing, most of them in trailers are from the 50s and are too old to move. I don't know how we're going to afford to hook up to the sewer. I know that we do not want to have only police protection. I do think that having some sort of police protection instead of the county sheriff saying they're too busy to deal with us, some kind of police protection is a good idea. But exactly how to make all this happen, I don't know, but I do think that this is the body that needs to consider the problems that we're facing and try to figure out how.
Thank you very much, Jesse.
Thank you.
I know that Glenwood is a great concern for many of us on the Planning Commission, and we it never hurts to remind us that there's lots of residents there who are concerned about affordability and utilities. Next we have on our agenda is a legislative public hearing relating to Springfield Development Code Amendments, Small Wireless Facilities, and the Right-of-Way. And first of all, it was pointed out to me that under the Springfield Development Code Order of Procedure, that the presiding officer shall summarize the nature of the application and the applicable approval criteria. However, in general, we are deferring that to the city attorney and to staff, and I'm going to go ahead and say that I think it would be a good idea to continue in that fashion until such time as we can probably adjust the Springfield Development Code to reflect that. At this time, I'll give over to Christine Kraz, our assistant city attorney, to discuss the development code amendments relating to small wireless facilities and the right-of-way. Christina.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start out, because this is a topic where the technology is rapidly evolving. If we had talked about this a year ago, I think we would have talked about potentially different things. And so what I'm going to start with tonight is a PowerPoint from the League of Oregon Cities 5G Wireless Summit and a joint presentation materials that were compiled by the wireless industry in collaboration with the League of Oregon Cities. I attended this on October 25th. I think it gives a good background of what type of facility we're talking about. So this was like a whole hour-long presentation, so I'm not going to take an hour to go through it, but I wanted to use this PowerPoint because it has great examples. So really quick to summarize, the reason that this is that we're talking about this is that these facilities are, these small wireless facilities are going to be, according to the SEC, necessary for 5G service. So right now we have LTE. I'm not sure how to use the pointer. Oh, that works. Goes back, okay, forward. So right now we have LTE, 4G, and then 5G and beyond, it will, the goal, I think, is to increase the amount of data and broadband availability to residents. And so the Internet of Things is something that's typically, it's commonly referred to as part of that 5G rollout. As I understand it, 5G is sort of a set of standards on wireless connectivity, the devices themselves, and the antennas and other technology that communicate and provide the telecommunication service. It's an international standard that's set, so it's no U.S. government regulatory body, but it's sort of an overall international body that sets those standards. This is an example that was provided from AT&T, just showing the increase in data that's happened in the last decade. Those of you that have been on the Planning Commission for a while are accustomed to reviewing applications for macro cell towers. These are the large cell towers that you see around town that have antennas all the way around. That is kind of gives you an overview of a macro cell is intended to cover a large area. But in addition to that, there are things called small cells or small wireless facilities that are more at a local level. They're lowered to the ground. They transmit in a higher frequency, which means that they can carry more information because their wavelengths are shorter, but they don't go as far. Because of that higher frequency, the waves don't carry as far. So they're very good, I think, as I understand it, they're very good at providing the high traffic, high demand service, but they're not your only strategy. I think most wireless companies are saying they're going to need some combination of both moving forward. It's not an either or. So the difference between a small cell and a macro cell is primarily the size of the antenna, although there are what are called small macro cells that look more like traditional macro cells and how they're assembled, but they are smaller. So this gives you an example of the antenna, one of six to 12 per pole on the the right are larger, and then a small cell antenna is on the left. This is not to scale. This is AT&T's diagram. It's not at all to scale, so it's not my favorite, but it gives you an idea of what types of facilities you're talking about. That 6-foot man is like way too tall in proportion to those other two. And let's get through some of these. So on the right here, you see a small cell installation on a utility pole, and on the left, what you see is a small macro cell on a utility pole. So the regulations that we're talking about would technically allow either of these because they're allowed under the FCC regulations, but the macro cell site that's on a utility pole has to be small enough to fit under the size limits that we're going to discuss. I thought it would be helpful to give you the pictures before we get into specifics. This is an example of what's on a pole typically with a small wireless facility. There's the antennas, there's fiber and coax conduit, a power conduit, a power disconnect. This is an emergency disconnect that's supposed to be more accessible so that you can shut power off to that antenna. Most of these antennas have safe distances that the operators can't get within a certain, that you don't want an operator right up next to it when it's on because of the radio frequency. The FCC says they're safe from the ground level. We can't regulate that, but there is a reason to provide the power disconnect at a lower level. These also will connect into fiber from pole to pole, and that will be through the city's encroachment permit process and not part of the development code, either underground or on the line with the other communications lines. And then these are just some, I'm going to go through kind of quickly just some photo examples and photo simulations that were provided by the wireless industry for what these could look like. This is an example of a light standard that has the antenna on top. These are different antenna varieties. An example of an AT&T antenna. T-Mobile has a slightly different design. Each provider has a variation on design, and then some vendors that the wireless providers use have their own variations as well. So there's no sort of one standard or one solution that gets rolled out everywhere. This is an example of what it could look like on a utility pole. I think it's that same pole from a different angle. This is one with it on the top. This is actually from Eugene. And this is out there right now. I'm not sure exactly where this is, but you can see the antenna is above that light standard. It's that little cylinder that sticks out. And then the equipment is the brown box down below that. These are more examples. Strand mounts are another type of technology. When we get to the code later, you'll see that we've modified a current exemption so that these would not require development review. These are much more minimal as you can see, you can hardly tell that's there. It's not attached to the pole, it's actually attached to the cables that run pole to pole, and traditionally that hasn't been something the development code has regulated. Some more examples of what those look like. As you can see, they're much smaller than the others. Antennas. This is an example of an antenna on top of a light pole, that wider thing that goes up is the antenna. And then you see the two equipment boxes down below those flags and above the no parking sign. That's another example. This is a photo simulation from Gresham, Oregon. They do have the option to install, some carriers can install camouflage light standards, so all of the equipment is inside the pole. The pole itself is a cabinet that opens. They're more camouflaged in terms of what they are, but as I understand that, they're much wider. They're a utility pole diameter instead of a normal light pole diameter, and so the one potential concern could be as you're looking down a street, you may not notice the equipment, but if you're used to seeing all the same light poles, you wouldn't see all the same light poles. You'd see one or two that stand out. That's another example of a taller one. And then there are other designs that don't put them directly on top, but they come out and then up. And this is one that's entirely camouflaged. This is there's a similar simulation to this where that box at the bottom, in this picture it looks like that's sort of a trash can sized. And a lot of these photo simulations, I don't think that they're quite as accurate as they could be. That's actually more, a lot of those are actually more my height. So they're very tall equipment boxes with a pole on top of them. It's hard to get that perspective always in a photo simulation. There's also options to do decorative poles. This is something I think that's a little bit newer. They've been coming up with decorative solutions where they are intended to blend in. In Springfield, we do have decorative poles. We have them downtown and in other special areas. And some more examples. And then there are also, the code would allow a wireless only pole. The FCC, I think, makes us allow these if there's a need for that wireless capacity or service and there isn't an existing light pole or utility pole, then we could be seeing poles that are only intended to support a wireless installation. I think I've heard that's not the preference of wireless providers. They would prefer not to have to own and be responsible for the poles. But that is one thing that could see the attachment of these facilities. Some designs for Portland, these I think are photo simulations. Portland hasn't adopted design standards. They're working on them, so I don't know how these designs stack up in comparison to their standards. Another option that you may see in some places are attachment to traffic, the actual traffic signals. A lot of our traffic signals are in ODOT right-of-way, and ODOT currently does not permit these in their right-of-way. So I don't know how likely we are to see that in Springfield. Okay, so that was that part of it. Now I would like to go to an overview of Okay. Does anybody have any questions about just the technology overview? Okay. So the code. I wanted to give some background on the Telecommunications Act, because this is really our basis for bringing this forward to you. So that the Telecommunications Act is a federal law that was passed in 1996, and it prevents the city and any state or other local government from unreasonably discriminating among providers of functionally equivalent services, or from prohibiting or having the effect of prohibiting the provision of personal wireless service. So the FCC in October, late September, came out with a declaratory ruling and third report and order that was specifically intended to address small wireless facilities in the public right-of-way to make way for the rollout of 5G and to address, I think, data needs under 4G that we have now. It interprets the Telecommunications Act and what it means to have the effect of prohibiting service, and essentially states that if you don't comply with the rules the FCC has laid out, you will have the effect of prohibiting 5G in your city. And so it preempts the city from regulating just under our own discretion and prerogative. The areas that it covers are fees that the city can charge. That's not something that you'll be considering. It's the development fees. The fees have to be tied to cost. In the development code, the fees that we charge under there have been reviewed in the past, and they're reflective of the time that staff takes to review these. So where it really impacts the city is in our ongoing charges for our right-of-way, but that's not something that falls under the development code. Aesthetic standards and then presumptive timelines for permit approvals are the two things that really are implicated by the development code. The aesthetic standards under the FCC rule must be reasonable, no more burdensome than those applied to other types of infrastructure deployment, objective, and published in advance. And so by adopting them into the District Development Code, we're complying with the requirement to publish that in advance. There can be no absolute undergrounding requirements or any other undergrounding requirement undergrounding or otherwise, that materially inhibits wireless service. And minimum spacing requirements were one type of aesthetic standard that the FCC talked about likely could not meet the four criteria they set out. They also adopted shot clocks for permit approvals. So shot clocks are timelines that the city has but to approve or deny a permit. And if the city doesn't comply with that, then they can file suit in federal court. And if they win in federal court, then an applicant asks a judge to order the city to grant all permit approvals. So building permit, encroachment permit, essentially as the applicant submits it. So it's a permanent grant. So the city then doesn't have any ability to review or make conditions of approval on those. The shot clocks apply to all approvals that the city issues in one go of it. So it's development approval, a public right-of-way, and pole attachment agreement. That's the a contract with the city that allows them to enter our right-of-way and attach facilities there. It includes things like payment for that, and then indemnification. If somebody hit a pole and it fell onto a car, then you know, we would be responsible for those damages. And encroachment permits are the permit the city gives for access to the right-of-way on an individual facility basis. And then building permits, these are most likely going to be electrical permits for attaching the different elements of the facility. The issue that we have now is that most of these facilities in our public right-of-way would fall under discretionary use approval. And for those of you that are new to the Planning Commission, discretionary use requires a notice 20 days before a public hearing to surrounding property owners. It requires a public hearing before the Planning Commission, and by law, any affected party has the right to request the record be left open, which could extend that decision out another 21 days. Then there's the opportunity for appeal to the Springfield City Council, which adds additional timeline and additional opportunity for requirements for notice and the record being left open, etc. So it would be nearly impossible to accomplish that in 60 days if someone requested appeal and someone requested the record open, and it would be difficult to do it in 90. And so the reason that we're bringing this to you is to address that concern. So an overview of what the proposed code does. It applies to the right-of-way in city limits only. Lane County owns some right-of-way within the city, mostly Bostrop Parkway. And any facility in this area would require Lane County's authorization as the right-of-way owner. So we did not include the urbanizable fringe in that. Because it would require Lane County approval. We limited it to within the city limits because it doesn't require co-adoption with the county to make this process go quicker, and because we're really responsible for our own right-of-ways in our city. We can also use this to allow them in Lane County right-of-way if Lane County decides to do that and it's been annexed. In the future, if Lane County wanted to allow these in their right-of-way outside our city limits, we could work with them to re-adopt through a co-adoption process. ODOT doesn't currently allow any small wireless facilities within their right-of-way, and I don't know that they have plans to do so. And they expressed no concerns with, when I sent the code to their representative, Bill Johnston, he said they didn't have concerns with the understanding that we would not allow something into ODOT right-of-way without ODOT's approval. The code is drafted, essentially does two things. It allows for ministerial or administrative type 1 review for these facilities, which is a staff-only decision that's based on objective standards, which also allows for the concurrent review with all of those other city permits. So we can sort of consolidate and have one process. And then it adopts standards for these facilities under that process. If a facility was proposed and didn't meet the type 1 review standards, then it could still be approved through discretionary use outside of the FCC's mandated timelines and standards, because it would not fall under the definition of a small wireless facility. The next steps will be that the FCC rules will take effect on January 14th, 2019, and the City Council will have a hearing and deliberations tentatively on January 7th. So I wanted to turn real briefly to the criteria of approval and make sure that I cover those. The criteria of approval are under Springfield Development Code. I had it up. My apologies. Springfield Development Code 5.6-115. And their consistency with the Metro Plan, applicable state statutes, and applicable statewide planning goals and administrative rules. Communications facilities are covered under the city's urbanization element. That element has been adopted but is not acknowledged yet by LCDC, which means that we would have to apply any applicable statewide planning goals. Because these facilities are in the public right-of-way as opposed to on private property, they don't implicate any statewide planning goals directly, so the amendments are consistent with the statewide planning goals, and they're consistent with our urbanization element, which requires us to make sure that key urban services and facilities can be provided to new development. So the There are no directly applicable statutes to these types of facilities. The Oregon Public Utility Commission regulates pole attachments to utility poles, but that's outside of our development code, and nothing in this conflicts with that. Springfield Utility Board is the electric utility owner, and they would ensure through their approval process that those comply with the state law. I think sort of within that, applicable state statutes would be applicable federal law that overrides our ability to make contrary decisions. So as I outlined it, the federal law is really what's on point. If there are no questions, we'll turn it over to public testimony. Yeah.
Could you go back to that screen on the ODOT?
Yeah.
On the previous screen? Now it's saying that ODOT does not currently allow small wireless facilities within their right-of-way. And then below that is saying that you would go turn to ODOT for approval. So what would you be approving if they're going to deny facilities?
Well, we likely wouldn't be approving them. When Bill Johnston replied, he said, "With the they might grant exceptions," and I don't know what that process is. I don't know what their decision-making through the state is going to be on how to comply with these new FCC orders and rules, which could be read to say that ODOT has to allow them. So we gave them notice. We gave them a copy of the first proposed code. I didn't have time today to send them the updated version, but I will do that tomorrow, or if you have a recommendation tonight, we'll send them that update.
So that doesn't necessarily mean then that they would not allow facilities, is it?
They currently do not allow them. That's their current policy. He mentioned something about granting an exception. I don't know anything more than that, okay, whether that's something they regularly do or not.
Procedural question.
Yes.
Are you taking questions on the code itself right now or just the presentation?
I think I would prefer to keep it to questions to the staff report, unless you have something you want clarified before you hear public input, but then I'll do a summation, and then I can answer questions during your deliberation as well.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Christina. Next on the agenda is testimony in support of the proposal. We have two people to testify in support. The first is Alan, I believe, is Baez. I can't exactly read it.
Oh, it's just Alan Barr, sorry.
Alan Barr.
Easier than that.
Please come forward, read your name and address for the record, and thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, commissioners, thanks for having me here tonight. My name is Alan Barr. I work for Verizon Wireless, on the network engineering team. I work in Portland at 5430 Northeast 122nd Avenue. And I am one of the guys that helped put that presentation together. I really appreciate that she did not make you go through all 55 pages of it in an hour. She saved you a lot of time tonight. But I have also been meeting with councils and staff ahead of the FCC order, working on ordinances and agreements so that cities can be prepared and be compliant. And just let me give you some quick fun stats. 52% of American households are wireless only for voice. Millennials, two-thirds live in mobile-only households. 70% of adults, 25 to 34, who rent, live in wireless-only homes. And there's been a 238% increase in data use in the past 2 years to over 13.7 trillion megabytes of wireless data traffic. That is really why I'm here. We can't keep up with the demand. People want to watch the game on their phone or their tablet, the latest blockbuster hit. If you have a bunch of digital natives like I do at home, they're always watching YouTube. Some of the fun things I like to use data for are, I'm going to FaceTime my kids on the way home tonight and wish them good night. I like looking in on my three-year-old twins at daycare 24/7 on their video cam. I'm a big fan of the Click It shopping, where you can put your shopping list into the grocery store and just drive up and pick your groceries. So people are really in need of these services. And perhaps you know here in Springfield some coverage gaps. We can't even keep up with the current demands. There are places everybody knows where they can't get good mobile services. That's a big draw for where people want to live. 76% of all 911 calls originate some from a cell phone, so it's also a life safety issue. There's just more wireless devices than Americans now, 1.2 devices for every person. And so, Ms. Kratz, thank you, has been wonderful to work with, and you know, we've provided a comment letter, which she's taken under advisement, we're just looking forward to working with the staff to make any needed changes to your wireless code so it can be durable and compliant with the federal law. For deployment of better 4G service for Verizon and 5G when it becomes commercially available. We want to make sure that we partner with you to address any aesthetic concerns you guys may have. It is your right of way, and we really do have a partnering philosophy with the city. Where we want to make sure that you guys, you know, your constituent not only get great coverage, but we address any concerns you have. So I'll leave my cards and stick around for questions. I also have hard copies of the presentation she did. If you do want to read all 55 pages, I'll leave those with the clerk as well.
Thank you for your testimony, yeah. Mr. Barr. And our next testimony is from George Granger. Could you come forward? Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. Thank you also for having me here tonight. I'm George Granger. I'm with AT&T. And my address is 819 Southwest Oak Street, Suite 600, Portland, Oregon. Before I get into my brief comments, I just want to thank Ms. Kratz also for coming to the Small Cell Summit that she showed you the presentation from. We were all very excited about that because it was a tremendous collaboration between cities and the carriers to really get into detail about some of the opportunities and challenges that we jointly face and how we can overcome them. And it was led by the Oregon League of Cities, as you saw, but you know, it was facilitated by the Technology Association of Oregon. So it was really a tremendous effort. So I'm just here tonight to speak in favor of the city's adoption of the wireless code changes that will allow for expedited approval of small cell wireless facilities in the right of way. We provided some comments through this process to Ms. Kratz for her consideration, and we appreciate that she seriously considered those changes. And we know that as we move forward, there may be some additional changes we'd like to raise with city staff, and that those changes might be then considered by the city council. AT&T supports a code change to facilitate, as the gentleman from Verizon was saying, the expeditious deployment of some of this technology that will really enable the future for residents of Springfield. To see if there's anything else, I'm just trying not to repeat what has already been said. I guess I just want to reiterate again that we understand that there's further opportunity to continue to refine the code before it goes to City Council. We look forward to continuing to work with you and then ultimately providing this investment in Springfield and the technology and benefits of that to the residents of the city. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have received no testimony opposed to the proposal, nor testimony neither in support nor opposed to the proposal, unless there's someone who's just come in. Time for questions from the Commission. Commissioner Sherwood.
So one question I had for you was just regarding in page 13 of 22, the small wireless facilities are not permitted on decorative light poles, and no decorative light poles will be removed or replaced to accommodate small wireless facilities. And then there's an exception I see. I was just wondering, I saw in the presentation there were some examples of decorative poles with somewhat matching facilities on there. Why are we moving toward not allowing those?
So it would be upon a determination that no other option is reasonably available for meeting the identified capacity, then we could approve them as long as they match. So that what the City Council has previously given us direction through the public right-of-way use agreement was that they didn't want these on decorative poles at all. And so our agreement that we've drafted and that they've given the approval to go ahead and negotiate with individual wireless companies to allow them in the right-of-way, said we don't want these at all on decorative poles, and so I viewed this as a middle ground. It's the last option, and if it needs to be used, then they have to match. So it's the city decorative light pole project, at least downtown, has been an ongoing effort. People have sponsored those poles. You'll go around town, you'll notice that people have sponsorship plaques there. And so I think we don't want to just cavalierly allow those to be removed, to be replaced with something that looks similar, but not exactly the same.
Okay, that makes sense. One more question I have about that is just following up to that. I know there's a difference between what is possible and what's optimal as to co-location and just location in general of these. So would a sacrifice in co-location optimization be made in order to not have them on decorative light poles?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
So if there's one spot that is optimal and another spot's reasonable but not optimal, and the reasonable spot is not on the decorative light pole but the optimal spot is on the decorative light pole, would you go for the reasonable as opposed to the optimal? Is, I guess, my question. I don't know if that's clear in the code itself, but just in terms of application, because I know there could be an argument made by an applicant that they would want it to be there, but we could say it doesn't have to be there, but we do acknowledge that we'd be better for cellular users.
So as I understand it, the way that, because I've met with one vendor for one wireless company about their proposed locations, my understanding is there's sort of a dot on the map of where that coverage or capacity need is, and that dot sort of placed without reference to, like, where's the right-of-way. It's based on, I think, mapping. And then the vendor or the person who's proposing locations to the city identifies some options within a very, usually very small radius of that location. And so I think what we would do is we would say, okay, well, is there, within that radius, those three or four potential poles, if one of them isn't decorative and it can be attached, it's reasonable to attach it to that pole. And it, you know, it doesn't, there's not another, the way that these, as I understand, they need to be offset from each other to fill gaps, and the way that they could interfere with other existing traffic signals or something else, it may be that in some locations there is no other reasonable. But I think the intent was if there's two basically similarly good poles and it's reasonable to attach to either of them, one's decorative and one's not, let's put it on the non-decorative pole.
Thank you for the clarification.
Commissioner Bowles.
One small correction, I think, maybe needs to take place. On page one on your order and recommendation, on the second paragraph and the second sentence, it indicates that these rules will become effective January 14, 2018, rather than 19.
Oh, okay. Thank you. We can correct that. That's a good idea. It's hard to adjust my timing on what the year will be. One thing I did want to bring up that I meant to do in my initial presentation was there were a few comments that we got that I received from Verizon and AT&T's legal counsel. I didn't give you those, their markups, as public comment. It's in my record, but I didn't give it to you to read as the markup because I didn't know if it would be helpful. But if you would like that before you, if you decide to meet again and you would like to see those markups directly, I'm happy to give them, to send them out. I received them on Friday and then today. Or possibly Monday and today, I'm losing track. But one item that was a point of contention in the written comments that feedback I received was that the restriction on no more than two antennas for antenna arrays may be located on a single pole. My understanding had been that one, typically there would be one antenna for 4G and then an additional antenna for 5G on some poles. But the feedback that I got is that it could be as many as three to five antennas. The standard there would be whether it's reasonable for the city to restrict the number of antennas as an aesthetic standard. And so that's something I wanted to bring up to you. There were other comments that I received regarding sort of general updates to the city standards that apply to macro cell towers. And this project is intended to be very limited in scope to small wireless facilities. And so I haven't made any of those other broader changes to the standards the city would apply to the siting of macro cell towers. And we could revisit that, I think down the road that would need county co-adoption, because there are those outside the city that we approve. There were also a few other minor, I think, suggestions from AT&T and Verizon that I, based on my prior conversations with city staff, did not reflect in the updated recommendation. Based on city priorities, one of those is an ability to allow the city engineer to approve attaching utility metering on a separate pedestal in the right-of-way. So you would have a separate small pole with a utility meter and then your main pole. City and sub-staff have met together previously and talked about that and reached an agreement that sub would allow them on the pole itself with city review to make sure that that's not obstructing pedestrians. Another alternative would always be to look at them outside the public right-of-way if there was a private property owner that was willing to lease that, and then we wouldn't be involved in that part of the decision-making. So I just wanted to flag those two items as things that I got feedback on that there was disagreement and I did not include in the updated draft, but I wanted to make sure that you were aware of that comment so that you could include that in your deliberations.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Sherwood.
So just a jurisdictional clarification. As far as you covered the urban growth boundary, and a lot of times when we are talking about these issues, we meet together with county.
Yes.
In terms of the cell phone towers, does the county just make those decisions themselves without the city coming into them on urban growth boundary?
Any development that happens within the UGB requires city development approval. So if there was an application for an attachment in the public right-of-way outside of the city's boundaries, then we would apply the code that has been co-adopted by Lane County, but Lane County would have to give their permission as the right-of-way owner. So my thinking on that is that in order to comply with the FCC order, the minimum that we need to do is to ensure that these are allowed in our right-of-way. And so to ensure that we can do that in the right timing, I did not include co-adoption by the county. So if the county would like us to do that so that they can be in, if that's the same way that they interpret what the FCC order means for them, then we would, I think, be happy to work with them to go through that process. But I wanted to bring you the minimum the city needs to do to comply.
Thank you. That makes sense.
I think it's time to talk about a point of order, because actually the time frame for this meeting is unfortunately expired, and at 7:30 we were supposed to convene the special meeting for the Committee on Citizen Involvement. And I'm not sure how we should proceed at this time, because I have a number of questions, and I think we need to go through a lot more information before we can make a determination or a recommendation to the council.
Chair, you can move forward. He doesn't have anyone here for his hearing.
Legally, it's a concern to begin a public meeting earlier than you've announced it, but it's generally not a concern to begin one. Legally a concern to begin one later, if that's what the commission elects.
I'm going to go ahead and ask for consensus that we just continue this meeting until we're concluded. Okay. Thank you. All right. Further questions from the commission? Would this be an appropriate time to question some of the findings?
Yeah.
Okay. In particular, I had a problem with finding number 7, which is to reduce the economic gap, which is otherwise sometimes known as the digital divide, which is between kind of depending on saying that lower income people and certain communities are not served by wireless as well as upper income or more densified communities, so that maybe rural folks also are subject to the digital divide. And I really can't see, personally speaking, and maybe there's something I'm missing, but I fail to see how provision of additional supply, which is what this basically is doing, has anything whatsoever to do with distribution, which is how the digital divide is, that it's not distributed to people. It's not that there's not adequate supply, but it's just that there's not, it isn't distributed. So if the force of the new small wireless facilities are to largely also serve 4G and 5G system, then access to these also very likely will include either upgrades to, significant upgrades to existing devices, or purchasing of new devices, which we know the cost of some of the cell phones and tablets are really pretty significant. So can we discuss how this does meet reducing the economic gap between, how was that determined?
So I included that finding because it was similar to findings that were included when the city updated the wireless code altogether in 2014, and I think the underlying premise for that is what was articulated by the FCC, which I think there's disagreement about that conclusion, but the argument that was articulated by the FCC is that to the extent that governments reduce potential barriers, that makes the technology more widely available and more deployable, and that is one aspect of one contributing factor to a digital divide. It's not the be-all and end-all, and it doesn't solve the problem, but it's one piece of the puzzle. And if the commission doesn't feel that that's an appropriate finding, or that that's not, that won't have that effect, then certainly that finding does not need to be in there, and I could remove it.
Okay, and was also noting that, and this is, I guess, in regard to the technology, that since this does, it apparently is a higher frequency and a higher amplitude wavelength in the 5G system. Now, does the same FCC regulations regarding perceived safety standards still apply to this new system, to the new technology, as it did to the old technology, which had a much lower amplitude and much longer wavelength?
I don't have specific information about how or what FCC health and safety requirements apply. They are subject to health and safety standards from the FCC, and we're preempted from regulating the health effects of these. So we could not, my interpretation of the federal laws, we can't factor that in to our decision making.
The preemption continues for the new technology.
Yes, we are preempted we're preempted from all wireless communications technology from, you know, 2G that nobody uses anymore to 5G or 6G or whatever comes after that.
Okay. And then also under finding 10, that is in regard to goal one of community involvement. I guess I'd have to say that we're probably in compliance maybe in a de jure fashion in this, but because of the timeline that's been given, really because of the timeline we've been handed from the FCC, we really can't comply with the spirit of public involvement that we see under many of the other Main Street corridor study, all these other plans that we put forth. We really haven't got the time to involve the community much other than just complying with the law in regard to public comment. Is that
right? Well, we provided public notice through the newspaper, and then we reached out to other interested parties. This is public right-of-way that the city owns, so unlike other development processes, for example, transportation system plan can impact private property owners. So this doesn't apply to any privately owned property and what they can and can't do with their property. It does impact the citizens of the city in terms of what they see in their right-of-way, but the city can make decisions all the time about what happens in the right-of-way without a development process or public notice and comment. And so I think there's more being provided here than would be for a lot of other decisions the city makes about managing the right-of-way.
Well, like I said, I do believe it. It sounds as if it does comply, but it's, like I said, it's generally not in the spirit of how we try to involve our community in all our decision making. So it's, I guess it would just be unfortunate. So those were my questions.
Okay.
Do anyone on the commission agree with me regarding the digital divide and finding number 7?
Do me a favor, just restate that real quick, please.
That I believe that it's called the economic gap between served communities and non-served communities. I don't see how providing additional towers, additional small wireless, serves necessarily to close the economic gap between the people who have digital access and the people who don't, meaning poorer people or rural people. So I believe finding number 7 is erroneous, or at least partially.
So my thoughts on finding 7 are, first off, I believe it's important to offer any rationale that we can in making these changes and these amendments. And the reason for that is because it shows that we are making an effort, a good faith effort, in being compliant with Oregon Revised Statutes as well as federal law. I think that the reason that I agree with finding 7 is that if we see that people are continuing to increase their wireless use, we're going to see, and we don't see the supply significantly increasing along with it, because the increase in demand is exponential, we're going to see a growth in the digital divide. We're going to see that, especially with, you know, current events as they are with the treatment of wireless as a public utility, we're going to see people not have as much access to this or have to pay steeper prices for access to this if there's not an expanse in supply. So I think that finding 7 is relevant, and I think that it better shows why the city's making this decision when the state or federal government look at it.
Okay. Do we have summation by staff?
That was my summation. Do you have any other questions? I do.
One more question.
Yeah.
Commissioner Gill.
On page 7 of 22, under general standards, on 2 and 3, demonstrated need for WTS facilities and lack of coverage and lack of capacity. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why they can't tell us why those things are needed?
That was part of the FCC order specifically. So the demonstrated need and lack of coverage and lack of capacity are derived from Ninth Circuit case law regarding how to interpret the Telecommunications Act and what type of restrictions have the effect of prohibiting service. And so the FCC said everybody is going to need access to 5G in the public rights of way. There's no other way to do it, essentially, was the argument. And so you can't make them, we're presuming nationwide there's a lack of capacity, and they made findings under that order to support that. I will note that the FCC order is on appeal. There are several cities around Oregon, including the League of Oregon cities, are actually appealing parts of the FCC order because they don't agree with the preemption. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the fees and the ability of the city to charge the fees. I think even if the FCC order went away, I would think that new standards and a streamlined process would be of benefit to the city, even if that FCC order was not in place.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Do we have any requests for continuation of the public hearing, extension of the written record, or both? Hearing none, do I have a motion to close the public hearing?
I move to close the public hearing.
Second.
In favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. Do we have any discussion, including testimony or evidence addressing the applicable approval criteria or other criteria cited in the record as applicable to the proposal, or possible questions to the staff or public?
Commissioner Cuevas, if you're at the point that you as a commission are ready to make a motion, I do have some suggested changes to the findings to reflect the change of the city council schedule. So whenever you're ready, I could point out three places where I would recommend the findings be changed accordingly. So looking at the staff report, the second page, which is attachment 3 at the bottom, 3 of 30. So if you look at the largest middle paragraph there, the second to the last sentence, where it's talking about schedule of the Springfield Planning Commission on November 20th, 2018, and then I would say strike the word first city council public hearing, because there will only be one city council public hearing that we know of. So it would read, the city council public hearing is scheduled for, and then strike the rest of that line and the beginning of the following line, so that we have public hearing is scheduled for January 7th, 2019. And then the following paragraph, I would suggest striking everything within the parentheses. So we would leave the record open until at least December 19th, if that's true, to cure the notice requirement. But in fact, with the council hearing on January 7th, people can submit comments all the way up until January 7th. So just striking what's in the parentheses there. And then the third place is page 6 of 30. Under the third criteria, applicable statewide planning goals and administrative rules, at the end of that first paragraph. So we would change the date of the public hearing for council scheduled, instead of December 3rd, 2016, we would go January 7th, 2019.
Could we get you? That was a typo, it was not 2016.
Could we get you to write those?
Oh. I have, okay. Yes. I can bring those up to whoever's making a motion.
Okay. Do we have a motion to recommend?
I have one more comment. Just above that last amendment you made, concerning the Planning Commission hearing, you also have 26, or there also is 2016 on there, so I would propose to change that to 2018.
I am not normally a planner, so I apologize for these errors.
This was your question.
At this time, do we have a motion to recommend approval of modifications or conditions?
I wanted to check one more thing on the order. There is this date to, in terms of 2019, and then I'll just leave that.
So I would entertain a motion to recommend to the City Council.
Question for you. Is it possible just to say with additional amendments as mentioned by Planning Manager Sandy Wilson?
I think she read them all into the records.
Right. Okay, perfect. So. Move to forward recommendation to City Council to approve Journal Number 811-18-219-TYP4, amendments to the Springfield Development Code Section 4.3-145 regarding small wireless facilities in the public right-of-way within the Springfield city limits as proposed in Exhibit B to this agenda item, with the additional amendments mentioned by Comprehensive Planning Manager Sandy Belson. Because amendments meet the applicable criteria of approval. Thank you.
A second.
Do I have a second? So moved
by
Commissioner Sherwood and seconded by Commissioner Bergen. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. we have report of council action.
Yes, I attended council meeting last night. During the work session, they had two relatively long conversations, one about housing and a few grant sort of housing funds they have set aside, the grant funds they have to use for housing, and how to deal with some of the funds that need to get expended by a certain time. So they are releasing an RFQ hopeful to get some submissions on that. And then there was some discussion about the transportation enhancements, roadway enhancements, based on the bond that passed, the grants that were in hand, the changes in costs and ADA requirements, and trying to figure out which road projects to do first in what order. So they made some decisions. The staff gave them two different approaches to take, and they picked one of those. That was a tough conversation. They always want more money to deal with that. So, and then at the main council meeting, they had really three, four actions to take. One was the working out the agreements with the cable service, so it's Comcast. This was a first reading of an extension for the service, current service with Comcast, so that they can work on negotiations for the next full service. And then it was, I believe, first reading for some language in the municipal code to deal with solid waste management, the access or allowing people to be in dumpsters, to remove materials from dumpsters, to provide cleanup services around them. So there was quite a bit of public testimony from a couple of different businesses who would be impacted by that, and one person who received services. They did not, it was first reading, but they want to look much more deeply into this issue. There are lots of challenges on both sides, so they wanted to, they're gonna be looking at it again, for sure. There were several thank yous for the efforts on the city's part to work with the school district to get the old city administration building usable as an Egan Warming Center for a period of time until they tear down the building. So several public folks offered their thanks for that effort. There was one person who testified regarding the annex issues out on 42nd and 43rd and wanting clarification on those boundaries. And council directed them to connect with staff, and they appointed police advisory committee folks.
Further council meetings? Others? I attended the 9/24/18 council work session, of which was the interviews with our new planning commission members, and a number of other people, including reappointments. And it was very interesting, the discussion afterwards, that there was great support among all the councilors for all of our new members and our reappointment. And then there was a good discussion by Matt Stouter, who I believe is with, is he with Metro Wastewater?
Right, he's a city staff person, but he is charged with the administrative functioning of the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission.
And he was talking about storm drain issues in regard to abandoned and ill-functioning storm drain systems throughout the city, and what can be done to try to improve stormwater when private owners are not maintaining their systems. So that was a real good discussion. See if there's something that can be done about that. And then a real basic discussion of the sign code. That was meeting I attended. Business before the Planning Commission. I believe Commissioner Vose has a number of questions regarding our council liaison position.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to bring up a few additional items. I think it was at a recent meeting, I don't remember the date, where Sandy had mentioned the fact that there was a stipulation in the municipal code, is that correct? Stating that we needed to have a Planning Commission liaison to the City Council.
Those are the council operating procedures. So they put those in place each year.
Oh, okay. The reason that I requested the opportunity to ask a few questions and to make a couple of comments is that we did have a brief discussion at the time that Sandy presented that, and we have a volunteer that's willing to be the liaison is one item that we decided, and I think the second item that we decided was that we would continue to have our rotation, our normal rotation list, and continue that process. So the question, one question I have to begin with is, given that we have a liaison that's going to be attending frequent City Council meetings, should we as a Planning Commission consider removing her from the rotation, since otherwise she'll be doing double duty?
I would think so, yes.
That'd be a question for anybody that I work on.
I think it would still be beneficial to have the liaison attend the, or be in the rotation, because the liaison, from what I understood, would be, I don't want to use the word summoned, would attend when there would be specific items on the City Council agenda that would pertain to Planning Commission specifically. So who knows when that could be. You know, it could be extremely sporadic, and I wouldn't want to put undue burden on the other members of the Planning Commission to have one fewer person on the rotation.
Well, it would make a significant difference because it means once every six meetings rather than once every seven for everyone else. So that shouldn't be a major consideration in your thoughts. So, but that's an open question for anybody who want to maintain the seven-person rotation.
So you're thinking that you're not really going to be called on often?
I have no idea. It just depends what comes before City Council. I think there could be times where there's a lot of attendance. So, you know, in the past with discussing the TSP code amendments, our code updates, and I think in the future with development code updates, or even present, but I'm not sure what could ever come before City Council.
Sure.
Yeah, one, my understanding was always that our attendance on the rotation was hinged on whether or not there were things that concerned the council. We don't go to the council meetings to hear everything they do. We go to the council meetings to hear what they're doing that pertains to our position. So if there's an agenda, once the item that concerns the commission has happened on the agenda at a City Council meeting, we don't need to hear the rest, because all the other stuff, although it's useful to us as citizens of Springfield, it's not necessarily pertaining to the commission. So any clarification on that from staff?
I'd have to say that is not my understanding, but maybe there needs to be clarification.
I would agree. I mean, I've always gone there and stayed through the public hearing and the stuff, to just because it's a way of getting the feedback back to us so that we know what's going on, just to kind of keep us interwoven a little bit better.
The other understanding that I had about this process is that we are supposed to be a resource for the council if they have any questions about what we have been doing, which that's before we had this new position of the liaison. So that was another reason that we were supposed to attend the meetings regardless of the agenda.
That's also my understanding, too, that the entire meeting is germane to government, and we're a part of local government, and even if they're there to celebrate longevity of a city employee, that's a good thing for us to know about. And so you know, I really encourage people to attend. And I also think it would not be a good idea to remove the liaison, because I think each one of us, I think I spoke to this when we were discussing having a single person attend meetings. Each one of us has a particular point of view and a particular expertise, and I think it's very valuable for us to attend the meetings, because we're going to bring our own point of view, and we'll catch things. One of us will catch something that another one of us might not. So I'd like to have a full rotation myself.
Okay, the second question I have is, given that at many meetings we will have two planning commissioners at the meeting, the liaison and the person in the rotation, who of those two should be responsible for the report of council action?
One thought I have on that is that I think it'd be useful for the sake of consistency to have it be the liaison. I think that in any other case that maybe the liaison misses something that the other person thought was necessary, important, because he can't remember everything, then there could be additions. But I really think one of the issues I see with the rotation process as it's been is that, you know, certain people give a very, very in-depth report of everything, and other people only give a report of one thing that happened that really pertained to us or a project that we put forward. I think that consistency would be really nice for our meetings.
One thing I'll say in response to that is that when this was first instituted, which was 6 years ago essentially, it was requested that our reports be brief. So that was stated as, and of course everybody can interpret that as they wish, but the idea was not to get into specific detail of every comment that was made, to the detail of minutes, but as a brief.
Agreed.
Yes.
Mr. Lynn.
Just as a different perspective, I kind of like the idea of having a rotation of the reporting, just because, you know, we all see the elephant from different sides. I think the idea of keeping it brief is wise, and I appreciate that. I kind of want to hear, you know, how each person is seeing things.
I'd support that, Tim, personally speaking.
Well, and I would add to that that if the liaison is asked to be there for a purpose, she could report on that particular thing. So the person whose rotation it is can do the general, but then we'd want to know. I mean, if she's asked to be there and represent the commission,
directly that, and so that would be her role to do that specific piece. Okay, so is that agreeable then, that we basically split the duty at any time that there's more than one commissioner? Okay, the next question I have is, since we have a specific term for the chair and the vice chair, should we also set a term for the liaison at a certain time? We bring up for discussion whether to continue with the same person if they choose, or appoint a new person, same as we do with the chair and vice chair.
If I remember correctly from our meeting when we talked before, Sandy had mentioned that I had asked her if it renews at the beginning of the year, and she had said that it did.
And then the following question is, and this may be either for Sandy or the commission, is specifically when it's stated in the language that you presented that it would be that the liaison would attend meetings in which they were items of importance to the planning commission, what specific guidelines are there on what is important and what isn't? How is it determined when the liaison should attend a meeting or not?
Well, I think I would turn to Councillor Stair as your representative from the City Council. So my understanding is that if the City Council is wanting a report from the Planning Commission on something, that Councillor Stair would contact Commissioner McGinley and say, you know, we're going to be having our public hearing on the transportation system plan. It would be helpful to have the Planning Commission's recommendation explained to us in terms of what went into your deliberations. And so that she would then come in that type of a situation. That's how I have understood it. Granted, this is new for for this commission. I don't think you've had this in place, even though it's been in the wording. So I think it will evolve as we have more experience with the situation.
And one last item. Because of the fact that we are now focusing and emphasizing more the communication link between the City Council and the Planning Commission, I think that it would be important also, and specifically, Mr. Chairman, if we place more emphasis and focus on providing opportunities for the commissioners to give the reports. Now, up in the past, I used to take notes on meetings and then I'd have an opportunity to give the reports. Here in the last year or a year and a half, the opportunity has been pretty much hit and miss. There's been times where I've taken notes, and after 4 or 5 weeks of waiting and not having an opportunity to present a report, I consider the information essentially useless after a certain period of time. So I've gotten in the last year of it, I don't take notes at the meetings anymore because the opportunity does not present itself to give the reports. So I would like to place a little more emphasis on doing the reports.
I certainly agree with it. It's on the agenda. The few times I've seen it not happen is when we have a very, very long meeting, like for instance, the transportation system plan, where we had 35 people testifying, and we at the end of it, was everyone wanted to go. So.
Right, 10 o'clock
but,
meeting.
But it's still a lot of the information. I mean, the September 24th meeting. That's, you know, three and a half months ago. That storm drain information to me is, I think, is still very germane. And I also, you know, I did want to report the discussion on the appointment and reappointment of the Planning Commission members about how that went too. So I think that it's important to do this.
Right.
So I do support what you said.
That's all the notes that I have on this topic. So thank you, everyone, for your time and this discussion to take place.
Appreciate the questions. They were very, very good. Any other further business from the commission? Okay. Any business from the Development and Public Works Department?
Yes, I would like to take the opportunity to let you know that Councilor Wiley will be attending her last council meeting on December 3rd. So her term has ended. And so I believe there will be a celebration, acknowledgement, thank you, whatever it's going to be called, I'm not sure, at 5 o'clock prior to the council meeting that night. The other item I have to bring to your attention is that the City of Springfield and City of Eugene operating as the Metropolitan Planning Organization are considering putting an application together to seek to attend the Walkability Institute. I do not know a lot about this. I'm just learning about it today, but if a team is chosen from our area, the ability to attend this institute would be paid for, at least in majority. It is taking place April 22nd through the 25th, which is a Monday through Thursday in Decatur, Georgia. So we're looking to put together a group of 4 to 6 people that would include a combination of staff, probably an elected official from the City of Eugene, and we are considering whether we should have a planning commissioner represent the City of Springfield. And so we're looking at getting an application in. We applied last year and were not selected, so we're trying to try again. So if any of you would be interested in learning more about making something walkable and bikeable with hands-on experience in Decatur, Georgia, let me know, and we can talk further about how that would go and come back at your next meeting with some more information.
It's my understanding that our former planning commissioner, Commissioner Moe, will now be our new city councilor for Ward 2 taking over from Hillary Wiley, is that not correct?
Correct.
Great. We know his face well. Any other business? Hearing none, we'll adjourn this regular session of the Springfield Planning Commission and take a little break, maybe about 5 minutes, and then reconvene here for the committee for...